All right, morning, everybody. So we're continuing our discussion in Matthew 24 and the Olivet Discourse. And I believe last week we left off in, primarily we discussed verses 29 through 31. We spent a lot of time on those verses, and because those verses describe Jesus' parousia in detail, which is the purpose of the discourse in the first place. And we left off, we stopped last week in verse 36. So I'm just going to jump right into verse 36 and look at what that has to say. So verse 36 says, "But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." And obviously Jesus is still talking in reference to his return. Now, this verse is often proof texted by many people, primarily those who hold to the pre-tribulational rapture view and those who believe that the return of Christ could come at any moment. It's called the doctrine of imminency. And basically that means that at any point, even before I would finish this teaching, or right now, Christ could return. So they'll use this verse to say, you know, for Christians that try to give specific timing indicators of the return of Christ, they'll throw this verse out there right away, almost as a fear tactic to try to scare you from, you know, looking into this thing, looking into the return of Christ deeper and trying to establish, you know, specific events that will take place prior to his return. Now, in the context of everything we just went through in the last couple weeks, what are some things as why Jesus cannot possibly be saying that we won't know when he will return? Yeah, he just listed event after event after event to his disciples of things that they need to look for before he returns, which are, you know, timing indicators. If you guys remember when we talked about the abomination of desolation, we talked about how Jesus is drawing from Daniel chapter 11, which gives a specific time period for when the Antichrist is revealed and basically sets up his kingdom, to when Christ removes the Antichrist from power and sets up his kingdom. And the book of Revelation also gives that time period as well, which is 3.5 years. So if we know, if Jesus has given a specific event, i.e. the abomination of desolation, and we know when that ends and when the kingdom is set up on this earth, when Christ returns, then we will know the actual day of his return. I mean, we can basically, like I said, set our watches, and we will know. Now, how do we take the Jesus' statement here? How do we take the grammar? And that's the important part, is the grammar of what Jesus is saying here. Now, the word for know is here, is there's a lot of different words in the Greek language for this particular word for know. This particular Greek word is oida, which it's a perfect tense verb. And we've talked somewhat about the perfect tense, because Tim always harps on it. But the perfect tense implies a verbal action that was completed in the past with the results that continue on to the present time of, you know, when the speaker said it. Now, so what that implies is that it should be better translated perceive, or knowledge that comes by perception. And if you look up oida throughout the rest of the New Testament, in every case that it appears, perceive is a better translation. So Jesus is literally saying, but of that day and hour, no one has yet perceived. Meaning, the time when Jesus spoke this, the information hasn't been available yet. No one has perceived the time of his return. And why? Because we need a specific event, which the abomination of desolation, we need that specific event in order to know when the time would be of his return. So, you know, what he's saying here is that, you know, that his disciples at this time would not know when he would return, because we need this event in order to have that specific time marker of when he will return. And, you know, what's interesting is that God's operated in the same way in the past. If you remember, we talked about Daniel 70, and the prophetical weeks of Daniel 70 given for Messiah's first arrival. In Daniel 9, the Jews were given from a specific event, which was the decree of King Cyrus to rebuild the temple, to when Jesus or the Messiah would arrive on the scene. And in fact, from that decree of Cyrus to Jesus' arrival is the exact amount of time given in Daniel 9. So it would only go to show that God would operate in the same way and give us a specific event with the exact amount of time for his second coming. Do you guys have any questions about that? Makes sense? All right, let's go on to verse 37. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So Jesus gives this example of the days of Noah. And one of the things that is interesting about this parallel is how he says that life is continuing on as norm. People are eating, drinking, marrying, and giving in marriage, and they're just going about their daily business, and all of a sudden, things come upon them unexpectedly. Now, did Noah have previous revelation of, you know, the impending flood? Yeah, he did. You know, and for us, it's the same connection he's making with, he's giving all the believers, all his disciples, information about his return, so he's giving them information about judgment that's coming, which we will have beforehand, so that we can act in the appropriate way as Noah did by going into the ark. Now,
that last after the comma it says 39. So also with the coming of the Son of Man be. So it means it's like what you just said. It's going to be very similar.
Yeah, and. You know, to caveat in the verse we just went through with the not knowing the day or the hour, you know, Noah knew what was coming, and he was prepared. Now, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, Paul makes a very important point to believers about the Christ's return coming on you unexpectedly and how, and the danger that that can cause. In fact, let's turn there real quick. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Now, we went through 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 quite a bit last week. And 1 Thessalonians 4, we talked about how the resurrection and the catching away of believers takes place at the same time when Christ returns. And in chapter 5, Paul is continuing that same line of thought. In verse 18, you know, after Paul just got done talking about the resurrection and rapture or translation of the saints at Christ's return, he says, therefore comfort one another with these words. And then he says, but concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. So what do you think he's referring to when he says times and seasons here? Times and seasons of his arrival and the events that lead up to his arrival. Now, notice also he says that, you know, I don't need to write you, for you yourselves know these things. So, how would the Thessalonians have known these things? Well, he had just talked about Christ's return. The Thessalonians would be privy to Jesus' teachings about his return and all the events that we've been going through. So he's basically telling the Thessalonians concerning Christ's return and all the surrounding events, I don't need to write to you about these things because you know about these things. And he continues in verse 2, and he says, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. Now, we haven't gotten to this verse yet in Matthew 24 where Jesus gives the thief analogy, but Paul is drawing, you know, direct language out of the Olivet Discourse we're going through. Because the verse that we'll get through in Matthew 24, where Jesus says, know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would have come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. So Jesus is basically saying that, you know, if you're not watching, if you're not prepared, the thief, you know, if the master is not watching, the thief comes in, ransacks his house. So if you're not prepared, if you're not watching and know about these things, you know, you'll suffer devastation. Now, some people will take, they'll take Paul's words here and they'll say, he comes as a thief in the night. And they're taking it completely out of the context of what Jesus was speaking of in Matthew 24, which Paul is just, you know, expounding on. And they'll say, oh, Jesus' return is going to come as a thief in the night. We're not going to know about it. Just all of a sudden, poop, you know.
Well, they may not know about it, but the criticism is on the person who doesn't.
Yes, but they'll use it.
Goes on to say, you are not in darkness, you know.
Well, exactly what I'm going to get to there. And, you know, it's not that he's coming as a thief in the night and then all of a sudden, you know, poof, all the Christians are gone and their clothes are laying there and they're disappeared into heaven or something. He's using Jesus' analogy out of Matthew 24. So he continues in verse 3 and he says, for when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. Now notice verse 4. But you, brethren, are not in darkness so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. And I'll stop there. So what is Paul saying here? He says that if that day, his return, comes upon you unexpectedly, you're not one of the sons of the light. So that's a pretty fair warning to believers, especially those who use that Matthew 24:36 about not knowing the day or the hour as proof that we won't know it, because Paul is teaching the exact opposite and saying you're basically sons of darkness if this comes upon you unexpectedly. Now, in verse 5 where it says, verse 3 where it's talking about the wicked, they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them. It's the same parallel with the flood of Noah that Jesus is talking about in Matthew 24. That there's this, you know, oh, peace and safety, all is well, and then destruction. And actually the word for sudden there, in the Greek, it's an adjective that means unexpectedly. And Jesus used this, the same adjective is found in Luke 21 at the end of the chapter where Jesus is talking about his return to his disciples. And he says, take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life, lest that day come upon you unexpectedly, the same adjective. And then he says, for it will come as a snare to all those who dwell upon the earth. So again, you find this concept of if Christ's return comes upon us unexpectedly and we're not prepared, that is a very negative thing. It's never the idea that believers won't know this information is not anywhere in the scriptures.
I have a question.
Yes.
The word day, it says this day, is capitalized in the New King James Version. I don't know if that means something specific.
Well, there in the Greek, there's nothing to indicate something capitalization or capitalized. But the translators are recognizing that it's referring to a specific day and not just any day in general, right. i.e. the day of Christ's return. All right, we'll shoot back to Matthew 24. All right, so we left off in verse 40. So Jesus gives this analogy of the flood. And then he says in verse 40, then two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left. All right, so these verses have caused much confusion with regard to the pre-tribulational rapture. Now, in this context, if we're going to use these verses to support the pre-tribulational rapture, that Jesus is saying that, you know, one will be in a field and they'll be sucked up into heaven, you know, or one will be grinding at the mill and they'll disappear into heaven at the rap, you know, this pre-tribulational rapture. In that context, think about all the stuff we've been going through. We've been going through all these events and all these things that Jesus is listing, you know, that will take place before his arrival. Jesus obviously cannot be staying, especially in verse 29 when we talked about immediately after the tribulation. So these verses obviously do not mean, they're not talking about a pre-tribulational rapture. So what are they talking about? Well, one of the things that we need to keep in mind is when we read the Gospels or any scripture for that matter, if we come across something that's been taught previously, you know, by Jesus or the apostles, we should always go back to the original place that this concept was taught, understand the context in that original, when the revelation was given originally, and then we build upon that revelation after that. So here in Matthew 24, when Jesus says this to his disciples had already heard this teaching from Jesus previously. So when Jesus says this, they're immediately going to remember the things that he had taught them earlier in his ministry regarding this issue. So let's go to Luke 17, where Jesus taught this to his disciples previously. We will Luke 17, 22. Then he said to the disciples, "The days will come when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they will say to you, 'Look here,' or 'Look there.' Do not go after them or follow them. For as the lightning that flashes out of one part under heaven shines to the other part under heaven, so also the Son of Man will be in his day." So Jesus is obviously talking about his return here. "But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. And as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the Son of Man." Now notice here in verse 26 that he uses the plural, the days plural of the Son of Man. In other words, the days leading up to his arrival, not the day. You know, he's using the plural in the sense of things that will take place before his actual arrival. And then he gives the same analogy that we went through in Matthew 24, the flood of Noah. "They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so it will be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." Now I should note here where it says "is revealed." It's the word, the Greek word apocalypsis. And if you turn back to Revelation and you had a Greek Bible, it would say the apocalypsis of Jesus Christ. So what it's talking about here when Jesus says when the Son of Man is revealed, it's this unveiling of all the events that the book of Revelation contains, the seals, all the trumpet judgments and bowl judgments. That's what he's referring to here when he's talking about when the Son of Man is revealed. Because remember, in the beginning of the book of Revelation, it says the revelation that God gave, you know, to Jesus Christ concerning the things that must take place, you know, very soon. So verse 31, now notice it says, "in that day." So this is the day, remember, the days plural leading up to his arrival, when the revelation of the Son of Man happens, or all the things contained in the book of Revelation. And he says, "in that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in his house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back." Now, do you guys remember in Matthew 24 what those verses applied to in Matthew 20, in the Olivet Discourse? We talked about the abomination of desolation, when it says, when you see this event spoken by Daniel the prophet, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. The same words that Jesus is using here. So Jesus is talking about at the event of the abomination of desolation. Okay? And then he says in verse 32, "remember Lot's wife." Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. Now notice the language here now that we find in Matthew 24. I tell you, in that night, the night of what? The abomination of desolation and the fleeing. There will be two men in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding together. One will be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. So the verses that we looked at, that we're looking at Matthew 24, are coming out of Luke 17 here, that Jesus is connecting with the abomination of desolation, not with the actual moment of his parousia, or his return to the earth. Now, something that should be noted that's an important factor also to understand what Jesus is teaching here is the grammar, the way that some of these verbs are translated is a little misleading. The verb for taken here is it's a Greek verb. It's paralambano. And the preposition para means beside, and lambano means to receive. Literally, if I took Duke here and kind of embraced him, you would use paralambano. I would receive him beside myself. In the first chapter of John's Gospel, it's found where it says that Jesus came into his own things, and his own people did not receive him, or paralambano. So the idea of a forcible, taken by force or something like that is kind of derived from our English translation is not, the Greek verb does not connotate that. And left here is the verb aphiemi, which has some flexibility with how it's translated in the New Testament, but the general sense of that verb is to let go, leave, reject, forsake is another way it's used. Rejection is more of the idea of it. So if we use the more literal renderings of these verbs, what does it say? In that night will be two men. One will be received beside, or received, and one will be rejected or forsaken or left behind. Now, and what's interesting in verse 37, notice his disciples also understand that people are going somewhere. They're understanding Jesus' words to refer to that, because they ask him, they answered and said to him, "Where, Lord? Where are believers going?" And then Jesus gives a riddle. He said to him, "Wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together." Now, the other important thing too about the context of these verses is he gives the example of Noah and the flood, with Noah going into the ark, in refuge and safety before the judgment began, and also the angels coming to deliver Lot out of Sodom, which is the same idea that before judgment can start, God's people are delivered to these places of safety. Now, they're still on the earth in those examples, right? They're not, taken somewhere else. They're still on the earth. But they're given places of refuge. Now, we talked about Revelation 12 a little bit when we were talking about the abomination of desolation. But let's turn there real quick. Because when we talk about where will some be received and why will others be rejected, where are the ones being received to? And at Revelation 12 gives us that answer. Now, I won't read the whole chapter, but there's this, we talked about this before, there's this angelic battle that takes place. Satan and all his angels are cast down to the earth, which coincides with the abomination of desolation and the revealing of the Antichrist, which we talked about the strong delusion in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, which talks about that it's the coming in the power of Satan is that delusion. Well, the reason why is because Satan is going to be involved with that when he's cast down to the earth. Now, he's cast down to the earth and he goes after this woman, and we don't really have time to go into all the details of this woman, but we can talk about it later. But the woman consists of Jesus' disciples or the church as a whole. And in verse 13 it says, "When the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, to her place where she is nourished for times, times a half a time," or 3.5 years, this period that we've been talking about between the abomination of desolation and the removal of the Antichrist. for times a half a time from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So notice here that this woman flees into the wilderness, or God's people flee into the wilderness at the time of the abomination of desolation to a place that's provided for them. Now, notice here at the end, it talks about Jesus, it talks about Satan being angry with the woman because she's protected. She's got into places of safety. He can't harm them. He can't do anything about, you know, the situation that they're in, because now they're protected, protected supernaturally by God. So who does he go out after? Those who are not supernaturally protected by God. And where it says to make war with the rest of her offspring, it literally says the remnants of her seed, or it uses a Greek word to describe the remaining portion of the woman is who Satan goes after. So they're still part of the woman at large, but they're a portion of the woman or God's people that don't make it into the wilderness and the place of nourishment. Now, that's exactly what Jesus is talking about here in Matthew 24, about one being received and one being rejected or left. It's those who, disciples of Christ, who are being received into the place of refuge, and those disciples of Christ who weren't watching, who weren't prepared for all the things that Jesus talked about, that are left to face the devil in a supernatural way in persecution. And Jesus told the disciples the same thing. We've already mentioned this verse before in Luke chapter 21, where he says to watch and pray that you may be counted worthy, and he literally says to flee all these things that come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. So there's a sense of worthiness. He says, if you're counted worthy to flee, you will be in that category. So there's going to be some believers in God's people that aren't paying attention to these things, and they're going to be put through the gauntlet a little bit. They're going to be tested a little more than the others that make it into the place of nourishment.
A little more?
Well, I shouldn't say a little more, but
that group that fails probably includes those that would apostatize also.
Oh, it does. It when we went through the earlier verses in Matthew 24, when Jesus says many will fall away or become snared at that time, that group that is left to face the devil and his minions head on and doesn't make it into the place of safety and nourishment, they're going to have some tough choices to make. And
that's the Second Thessalonians, one of the two signs.
The great apostasy. Right. Yes, yes. And
in other words, there's some reason to look at that translation as a single event versus some gradual apostasy.
No, it's a single event. Yeah, it's not a... It would have to be something recognizable to the church at large, as opposed to some gradual fading away from...
Because there's always been a great apostasy in the way that people use it like that. There's always been people falling away. Yeah. So.
Now, you know, that doesn't mean the group that does not make it into places of safety, that aren't received into that place, that doesn't mean they're all, you know, their fate is sealed and they're going to apostatize. Some will make it through that time period. In fact,
some may choose to stay in that in order to, you know, reach other people. May not go to the place of safety. We don't know.
We don't know for sure. But notice in verse in Revelation 12, it also says about God's people during this time. Now I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren who accused them before God night and day has been cast down. And they," this group that we're talking about, you know, the woman, "and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives to the death." So in other words, they didn't love their lives and hold on to, you know, this present reality to the degree that they weren't willing to die for Christ and be a witness and a martyr. So some of the remaining portion that does not make it into the places of refuge will make it through and endure till the end. Now, the other thing too that obviously brings the question to mind is where is this place singular of safety? Or we would have to think places, plural, if we're talking about God's believers all over the earth. I think too much speculation into that could be harmful. And obviously Jesus gave the answer to his disciples when they asked him in a riddle form, which means he knows that that information could be damaging to the disciples of Christ having that information too early. But he said, wherever the eagles are gathered together, well, remember in Revelation 12 it said she was given two wings of a great eagle, so it's definitely connected with Revelation 12 and the fleeing of the woman.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Sometimes in translations they use vultures. Is that word specifically eagle?
Well, yeah, Matthew 24 uses carcass, wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Here Jesus uses wherever the body, literally, which can be referred to as a physical body, or a lot of times body is referred to soma as the collective, you know, Paul uses it, the body of Christ. You know, he uses that word for God, you know, the collective whole of God's people. But we need to remember that when the two witnesses show up, we talked about these two prophets from Revelation 11, they're going to be giving God's people additional information. You know, they're going to be prophesying, they're going to be doing all kinds of miracles, and they're going to be basically giving us the information that we need, because right now we don't have the information that we need to know where to flee to. We're going to have to be supernaturally told where to go, or someone's going to have to show up and tell us where to go. But Jesus's main point when he says, remember Lot's wife, is that what did Lot's wife do when they fled the city? She looked back. She wasn't ready to go. We don't know why she looked back, but she wasn't completely ready to leave, and she turned into a pillar of salt. So the indication for us is that when it is time to go, when we've been given the proper information, we need to go. It's not time to make coffee and bring your mug with you. I mean, it's time to go. So
no coffee.
Okay. Had to just look though, as far as the eagle and the vulture, the actual Greek has atos, which comes up as eagle first, so not vulture. I know some translations.
So you think it could have been because the translators thought it was
connected with the carcass,
like vultures eat corpses, that kind of thing.
That could have been the connection, but the word is actually an eagle.
Okay.
So, in Matthew 24, at least.
Yeah, we'll definitely have the information that we need. God's not going to command all these things about fleeing and leave us in the dark, you know, not be able to act on that command. All right, so let's go back to Matthew 24. Verse 42. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So we talked about this in 1 Thessalonians 5 about the thief in the night analogy, which Jesus is giving here. And he says, he basically says that if he comes at an hour, notice it's an hour, not day, an hour you do not expect, there's very negative implications because the thief would come and steal all your goods, implying that, you know, connecting that with our rewards and inheritance in the kingdom being taken away and ravished. Now, the important part grammar-wise in verse 44 is Jesus says, therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming an hour you do not expect. Now, the verb therefore be implies a static state, you know, just always continually be ready. But the Greek verb, it implies a transformation from one state to another state. It's used in the Gospel of John for Jesus, the Word became flesh. So in other words, through this, you become ready. Well, the this is the thief analogy. You know, not letting the thief come and break into your house. Through this example, you become ready, meaning the disciples of Christ are going to become into a state of readiness and preparation. In other words, it implies preparation on our part to be ready for his return. You guys have any questions about that? All right.
Or you could just use logic with that. I mean, obviously we don't know, and they say you have to know. So
yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, using negation, you can conclude
the obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now in verse 45, it says, "Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season?" So now Jesus goes into this parable about a faithful servant and an unfaithful servant. Now, the most important thing about this little parable here is identifying a particular servant that Jesus is speaking of here. Notice in verse 45 it says, "Who's the faithful servant whom his master made ruler over his household?" In other words, the master is Jesus, and he's talking about those who are in leadership positions or ruling over his household or all of God's people. So he's talking specifically about pastors or those who are leading God's people. And again, when we talked about the progressive revelation of things, we need to go back. If Jesus taught about this previously, we should go back to that example and get the context and then bring it into what we're looking at in a later passage. And if you turn with me to Luke 12, Jesus had taught this previously to his disciples as well. And he basically explained to his disciples who exactly he's talking about here. We'll go Luke chapter 12, verse 35, and this is in the context of the return of Christ as well. Jesus says, "Let your waist be girded and your lamps burning, and you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom his master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. And if he should come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." So Peter says to him, after he says this, "Lord, do you speak this parable to us or to all people?" Or in other words, do you speak it to us or to all your disciples at large? And Jesus says, "Who then is that faithful and wise servant whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season?" Notice the future tense there. Who Jesus will make ruler over his household to give them their food in due season. So he's talking about those who, pastors and shepherds is another term that's used form of God's people. And notice here that their primary goal is to give them food in due season or the proper teaching. Now notice it says in due season, literally, you know, at the appointed time. At the right time, they're giving them the proper teaching and instruction. And obviously that proper time is connected with everything that he had just previously gone through, all these events of the tribulation and leading up to his return. So notice here it says, those who do that properly and give their sheep, the shepherds that give their sheep the proper nourishment and information that they need, he says, "Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods." Now notice what he says about it's the same servant or the same group of, you know, the same subject as pastors, but he says, "But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and in an hour he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So this is a pretty strong warning to those who are teaching and leading God's people if they're not teaching them the proper instruction concerning his return and they're giving them false information about it. I mean, it says here that the evil servant, he eats and drinks with the drunkards. Well, the reason why Jesus is using drunkenness is because it's in the Old Testament, it's used as a metaphor for deception. Particularly in Isaiah 28 in the Old Testament, it, referring to the leadership of Israel at the time of Christ when they rejected him. It talks about how they're all drunk and they're vomiting all over the place because of this drunkenness. Well, they weren't literally drunk, but drunkenness causes your perception of things to be blurred. So that's why it's used as a form of deception. You know, when we talked about 1 Thessalonians 5 and, you know, being sons of the light and being aware of the times and seasons and the Jesus' return not coming on us as a thief, Paul says the same thing. Let us not be drunk as others do, but let us be sober. In other words, let us not be deceived and let us, you know, have the proper understanding of these things when they arrive. And you notice he beats, you know, he talks about, you know, he beats the servants. Well, obviously he's not, you know, it's a parable. But when pastors and leaders of God's people are misusing their authority, that's the metaphor, is they're beating up on God's people. They're not properly caring for them and giving them the things that they need in order to progress in the faith. Peter in 1 Peter 5, he explained, I mean, he said basically, he parroted exactly what Jesus is saying here, and he told the elders and the pastors in that chapter, he said, shepherd the flock of God, which is among you, serving as overseers. And he tells them how to do it. He says, not by compulsion, but willingly, and not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Then he describes the type of evil servants that Jesus is referring to here in Matthew 24. He says, nor ruling or mastering over those having been entrusted to you, meaning don't abuse your authority and lording over those in a domineering way to get what you want. And then he says, if you do the proper things, Peter in 1 Peter 5, he says, when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. In other words, the pastors who are committed to honoring God in the leadership positions that they've been given will be given great reward when Christ returns. And notice in Matthew 24 that Jesus says the rewards are given when he returns at his arrival. You know, here in Matthew 24 it says he'll be given all, you know, he will be ruler all of the master's goods, or they will be given more, a greater and more abundant inheritance in the kingdom.
It also needs to be said, and I hate to say it, but you have pastors or professional clergymen who avoid certain issues and don't preach on certain things because they're being paid and they're either passively or actively afraid of losing their jobs. They're going to be on the hook for that.
You've received your reward.
Yeah. I mean, the scriptures reiterate over and over again, you know, pastors or teachers that are put into positions, you know, in Jude and Peter, he talks about false teachers and how some have gone in the way of Balaam for profit. And unfortunately,
it's a passive thing in most cases. Better just learn how to do drywall or do something else.
Well, and unfortunately today, many of these leaders of these pastors and these people that are leading God's people are, their motivation for doing so is not You know, Peter says, not by compulsion, but willingly. Well, they're compulsively trying to control people for their own gain. They're not doing it out of a willing heart because they want to care for God's people. And they just generally have a love for God's people and wanting to help them along in their walk with Christ.
Is that something that they teach in seminary, though? Are they taught in seminary these false ideas, or are they taught
no.
the reality we're teaching?
Well,
because in seminary, Jen, they're primarily in most seminaries, this can't possibly apply to them because they're gone.
So they teach a pre-trib rapture in seminaries?
No, I'm not going to say it's a blanket statement in all seminaries. It depends on the particular denominational.
They're going to align with some denomination, which a lot of them are Baptist, so they're going to have that belief, or they could be, you know, whatever denomination supporting that school. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not just eschatology. It's a lot of things.
It's
instinctively avoiding areas that they know are going to get them in trouble. And
yeah. And that's why you don't have many teachers today. You won't walk into many churches and find them, you know, it's called exegetical teaching, or what we're doing here, which is verse by verse by verse, because they don't have to deal with. If they just teach certain little topics and verses here and there that are unrelated, they don't have to deal with every single one of these verses and give the meaning to their congregation.
It's more inspirational.
Yeah, it's much more topical and kind of like Dad said, so that they kind of can avoid some of these harder things that we must learn in God's Word. Now, the other thing too that I didn't mention in Luke chapter 12 that we went to about this same topic is, notice here it says that these pastors will be appointed their portion with the hypocrites, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, weeping and gnashing of teeth is always associated with Gehenna, or hell, in the New Testament. And notice there, it's a portion with the hypocrites. It's implying a move from one group to a portion with another group. And Luke 12 is even more in your face, what Jesus says. He says that they'll be appointed their portion with the unbelievers. So that's implying that they weren't in that category before. So it should definitely be a very strong warning to pastors to take a look at these things and make sure they're giving people in their churches the proper information that they need. So if you guys have any questions?
It's not just professional paid clergy. It's anybody who's teaching.
Yeah, I mean, it can be applicable to anyone that is in a position of somewhat authority over other people that are guiding them. All right, well, now it goes into Matthew chapter 25, which we're not going to go into today, but chapter 25 is part of this same discourse that Jesus is giving. In Mark 13, which also has the Olivet Discourse, it doesn't include what Jesus tells his disciples here in Matthew 25. But since chapter 25 is technically included in the same discourse that we're calling the Olivet Discourse, we will continue on the next couple weeks with chapter 25. Not sure how long it might take us, but we'll go through all of the rest of Matthew 25 so that we can get through the whole Olivet Discourse as it was given. All right?
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm.